Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just how bad is the mortgage mess slash credit crunch going to get? That's what's keeping investors up at night these days. And it doesn't help when the nation's banks keep dribbling out the bad news. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. And by the American Public Transportation Association, committed to an energy-independent America by increased use of public transportation at publictransportation.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday, the second day of November. Bank stocks got hammered for a second straight day today. Most are at 12-month lows. Some are sinking even deeper. It's all about the subprime mess. But while investors are spooked, some analysts say the sector is doing just fine. Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports.
Investors rushed to buy bank stocks back in September when big banks wrote off their bad mortgage bonds. Al Goldman of A.G. Edwards says those investors are rushing to sell now. They're unhappy that banks didn't air all their dirty laundry at once.
They thought they had swept the problems out, that management had faced up to it. But then management comes out and says, whoops, we've got some more write-offs coming. And some of the figures are large.
Wall Street buzzed with rumors yesterday that banks could declare another $10 billion in losses.
Investors are very confused about just what future write-offs they're going to have to digest. And that's what's causing the rather indiscriminate dumping of some good bank stocks.
Indeed, just as investors started selling, Standard & Poor's released a report saying banks are in good shape. Tanya Azarch is a managing director at S&P.
The banks are faced with having to write down bad loans, and they have provisions for this and they have capital for this. They'll struggle through it.
Azarch says banks are stronger today than they were 10 years ago because they're in more businesses.
So if mortgage banking is not so profitable or syndicated lending is not so profitable as it isn't now, they have credit card lending or they have international banking.
Azarch says stock investors are focusing on short-term losses. She's thinking long-term, as in 5 years down the road. But she admits the next 12 months could be bumpy for banks. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
This week, thousands of construction workers in the Persian Gulf Emirate of Dubai went on strike. They were protesting hard working conditions and low pay. But they also complain about the falling value of their wages. That's because Dubai's currency, like its oil, is linked to the dollar. So when these workers send their savings back home to India or Malaysia, their families say it doesn't go very far. As John Dimsdale reports from Washington, the falling dollar is putting a lot of pressure on Gulf countries to de-link their currencies from the greenback.
When the Fed cut interest rates again yesterday, so did Saudi Arabia, Dubai, and other oil-rich kingdoms. Even though lower interest rates are likely to worsen the raging inflation in their countries, they've decided to keep their link to the dollar for now. If oil-producing countries decide they've had enough, Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz worries the dollar's value could spiral down.
It has a certain symbolic effect of reminding everybody that the dollar is no longer the global currency, is no longer a good store of value. As people get reminded it's not a good store of value, people won't want to hold as much dollars, and that means they will try to sell their dollars, and that means the value of the dollar will go down.
If oil were priced in another stronger currency, euros, for example, oil exporters could be earning even more profits. But Princeton's Alan Blinder, a former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, isn't so sure they'll abandon the dollar.
They're receiving dollars in great gobs. So they have to decide what to do with these dollars. If they started selling them aggressively, that would tend to push the dollar down. They would be shooting themselves in the foot because they would impose losses on themselves.
If oil producers drop the dollar, Americans will find their weaker currency buys even less overseas. The trade deficit would probably improve as foreigners bought cheap U.S. products. But imports, especially oil, would cost more, and economists agree the biggest threat would be more inflation. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a modest gain to end the week. Details when we do the numbers. Today, the United States promised Turkey that it would help stop Kurdish PKK guerrillas from operating in northern Iraq. Dozens of Turkish military have died in recent PKK attacks. Turkey has 10,000 soldiers on its border with Iraq, backed by tanks and aircraft. Talks will continue this weekend in an effort to defuse the situation. Los Angeles Times reporter Borzu Deragahi is with us from Kirkuk. Good to talk to you again, Borzu.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Should we be worried at this point about, you know, the one relatively stable oil-producing region in Iraq coming under some question?
There's been a constant low-level counterinsurgency operations on the part of Turkey and Iran targeting the mountains where the Kurdish rebels are hiding out. Unfortunately for some of the farmers here, the bombing campaign came right during the harvest and disrupted it, costing people a lot of money. And also, there's just this increased perception that, you know, wow, Iraq is a really unsafe place. You know, forget Sunni Shia or Arab Kurd. What's this new dimension of chaos and violence here, the Turkish-Kurdish question raising its ugly head?
So what do you think that does to the climate of business investment there in northern Iraq?
Well, I think in Iraq in general, and definitely even more so in northern Iraq because of its history, there has long been this business culture that's really against investing, really prone to mercantile cash and carry ventures, you know, so that a guy who has a lot of money, he's much more inclined to buy a bunch of TV sets, sell them real quick, and then take his cash out of the country than to actually build a factory that produces shoes or some kind of widget that creates jobs. And this reinforces that. This reinforces the idea, especially among wealthy Kurds and wealthy Iraqis, that Iraq is not a place to sink your money. It's a place to quickly make some cash and get the heck out.
Certainly, this is not the first time that Iraqi Kurdistan has faced uncertainty. How have they dealt with it historically?
You know, there's this saying, the Kurds have no friends but the mountains. And historically, they've emptied out their safes, emptied out their inventories, gotten into their cars and trucks or on horses and headed into the mountains and hidden and waited for the situation to calm down and then came back and opened up their shops again slowly. And, you know, unfortunately for Iraqi Kurdistan, this has been a really great period of growth over the past 5 years, a rare period of stability. It's extraordinary what has happened to the Kurdish tiger in terms of the economy here.
Are you seeing signs already of that kind of flight?
Oh, definitely. I think that there's a real, like, for example, on the streets of Erbil today and yesterday, there's quite a bit less traffic than there usually is. There's less construction work. There's been a little bit of a halt to the massive construction projects that were going on as investors wait and see, wait, what's going to happen here? Is it going to actually, are the Turks actually going to invade or not? And so it's palpable, even with some stores hurrying to empty out their inventories for fear of a war.
So then who is propping up the economy there on even a semi-permanent basis?
Well, I think one of the ironic parts of this is that Iraqi Kurdistan has become one of the most friendly investment environments for international investors in the region because of that issue we were talking about, this fear of the Iraqi Kurds plunking their own money down into this place. You have a lot of foreign investors, especially from the Arab world and from other parts of the world, very eagerly buying up chunks of the place. It's really pretty easy to buy property in Iraqi Kurdistan. It's really easy to repatriate funds and profits from investments. And it's visible here on the streets what's happened here. And this is definitely going to slow that down. It's definitely going to make future investors think twice about coming here.
Borzu Deragahi is a Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much for your time today.
It's been my pleasure, Ted.
Investment banks on Wall Street have had a tough time lately. As we mentioned at the top of the show, most of the big firms have taken heavy losses from the subprime mortgage meltdown. Banks are slashing year-end bonuses and laying off staff. So finance types got a chance to blow off some steam last night. Traders from the likes of Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns faced off in the first-ever Wall Street Charity Boxing Championship. Marketplace's Amy Scott was ringside.
Let's get ready to ring the bell.
It looked like any boxing tournament. Tall models in tiny dresses, sweaty men in satin shorts, the occasional splash of blood on the canvas. But at the Extel Wall Street Boxing Charity Championship, the fans wore black tie and evening gowns. They paid up to $13,500 a table, and the fighters usually spend their days in suits, pushing millions of dollars around. Jarvis, the expected loss Buckman, won the first bout. He sells credit derivatives at Callion. Buckman explains the nickname.
In my business, it's a risk parameter that we use, so anybody familiar with structured credit derivatives, it's probably heard of the expected loss, but also it's a warning to my opponent that I'm the expected loss on his record.
That kind of bravado works as well in the ring as it does on the street. It's easy to draw parallels between boxing and trading. Electricity trader Matt Priskinis, nicknamed Cadillac, lost his bout to a private wealth consultant.
Both reward people who know how to, you know, take a few hits and stay in there. I think the only difference is that in boxing, at least you know the night you're going to get punched in the face. Trading, you never see it coming.
In the most exciting fight of the night, Shane's second coming Kinahan of Goldman Sachs entered to a chorus of bagpipes, only to get knocked out in the first round. Listen to him hit the floor. Kinahan's opponent, Josh the Matrix Weintraub of Bear Stearns, went on to win the Best Fighter Award, an engraved crystal champagne bucket. Unlike most of last night's boxers, Weintraub has some experience. He boxed in college. He laughs at the comparisons to Wall Street, where most traders spend the day on a computer or the phone.
That'd be like, you know, comparing bike riding and skydiving. It's just no comparison. It ain't brave sitting on a bond desk, right? It's just, you know, it's just a job.
Another fighter, David Minister of Pain Smith of Lehman Brothers, lost his bout. He wanted to do something groundbreaking.
I'm an out gay man, and there aren't too many out gay men in boxing.
Nor on Wall Street, one might add.
I just wanted to prove to myself and to the world that I'm not afraid to step into the ring with the meanest of them. That guy's pretty mean.
To get in the ring, all the fighters had to work with professional trainers, men who probably make a fraction of their incomes. USA Boxing official Mike Lemish refereed a few of the bouts. He's seen a lot of white-collar boxers over the years. When asked how these bankers fared, Lemish is diplomatic.
Well, you can see for yourself, you know, to kind of on the sloppy side, I guess that's a nice way of putting it.
In other words, stick to your day job. In New York, I'm Amy the Brooklyn Bruiser Scott for Marketplace.
And we've got photos of those Wall Street pugilists in action on our website, marketplace.org. And, you know, here in the office today, we were saying this investment boxing thing sounded like a great reality show. Well, last night, Hollywood writers voted to go on strike against the studios. So depending how long it lasts, the airwaves could eventually be filled with reruns and more reality shows. We'd like to hear your ideas for the next Top Chef, preferably with a marketplace twist. Go to our website and click on Contact. We'll read the best ones on the air next week. Could be your ticket to Hollywood. Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson in Dallas. Hello, David.
Hello, Tess. I fear you have not caught me at my best. They have sapped every bit of strength I had.
It has not indeed been a pretty week in the financial sector. These banks are getting hammered, but I have to ask, are they not laying in a bed of their own making?
Oh, I think absolutely so. It's just the problem is we don't know what's in bed. We've had more rumors and more gossip. Is Anna Nicole involved in this market?
She just might be.
And that's the only thing that's missing. We've had rumors that this morning the market was rocking along and we had these better than expected factory orders and what appeared to be pretty good employment numbers. Then they started this rumor that Goldman Sachs was going to take a $9 to $20 billion write off, which they later denied. But that set us south. Then they started worrying about Merrill. And then you start dredging back what they were talking about earlier in the week. And it's Bear Stearns CEO smoking dope. I mean, golly.
But, you know, I have to say, I feel like I heard a lot of rumblings about this just in late summer when we had the whole credit crunch and everyone was like, oh, my goodness, what's hiding out there? Are we going to is this going to stop at any point?
Well, it'll stop at some point, but I don't know when. And what the market was telling you today was it's probably not going to stop this weekend, because I know the Dow was up 27 points and the NASDAQ came around. But if you look at the financials, big names, there are four of them, four of them in the Dow Jones Industrials Average. Everybody owns them. And they were just hammering those because the fear is that there were going to be more disclosures over the weekend and there are going to be more disclosures next week. And it's not going to stop.
And, you know, you certainly wouldn't recognize that anything's wrong given the employment numbers today.
No, I mean, we've got some sectors that are just reporting great numbers. Remember the gross domestic product figures earlier this week?
Right.
I mean, they were marvelous. And yet, you know, I mean, you know in your gut that it's hemorrhaging someplace.
Well, I do want to ask you about one other sector, which is the oil and energy sector. And you look at some of these companies, Exxon, Chevron, oil went up over $96 a barrel this week. And yet we're still hearing bad news from the oil companies. How is that possible?
Well, their earnings are below what they were a year ago. And it's really intriguing. You got to think of it. Think of a lot of these are refiners. Well, the oil goes up, but actually gasoline prices haven't gone up anywhere near as much as oil has, and really up until just recently hadn't gone up at all. So they're getting squeezed. They're in many cases paying more for the oil that's coming in, but not being able to raise the price of gasoline. And so they're making a lot of money. They're just not making money like they used to. They're making it just fist over hand instead of hand over fist.
Oh, well, I guess we won't feel too sorry for them then. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Tess.
David Johnson down in Dallas. Coming up, video games aren't just for geeks anymore.
Well, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, and it drives changes in computer technology. And whether you play games or not, you're buying a PC or a Macintosh in some form or another.
But first, let's do the numbers. A bit of a rocky ride on Wall Street today. Those financial companies pulled the markets down at first. The shares rebounded later in the session. The Dow gained 27 points, 0.2%, to close at 13,595. The NASDAQ rose more than 0.5%, 15 points, to end at 2810. The S&P traded flat to end the day at 1508. For the week, the Dow was down 1.5%. The NASDAQ was up 0.2%. The S&P was down 1.7%. Merrill Lynch racked up its biggest decline in 6 years, falling nearly 8% after analysts warned of more losses. Citigroup lurched down 2% on worries the company could cut its dividend. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.32%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Consumer Consequences, American Public Media's online game, exploring what the world would be like if everyone on Earth consumed like you. Online at consumerconsequences.org. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Gatebook, here are events for Monday, November 5th. The Russian Prime Minister meets his Chinese counterpart in Moscow. The Department of Veterans Affairs meets to discuss benefits and services for minority veterans. And on this 5th of November, 1605, Guy Fawkes tried and failed to blow up the British Parliament in the famous gunpowder plot. I'm Alex Schmidt.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Social Security has many nicknames, among them the third rail of politics. Political candidates are often reluctant to offer sweeping proposals on how to fix the troubled program, but not this year. Recently, Illinois Senator Barack Obama accused frontrunner and New York Senator Hillary Clinton of not being truthful and clear on the issue. They've both proposed that wealthy Americans pay more in Social Security tax. Commentator Glenn Hubbard argues that doesn't get to the heart of the problem.
This month, Kathleen Casey Kirschling, a retired Maryland teacher, applied for Social Security benefits. And we should all take notice. Born January 1, 1946, her application for early retirement benefits makes her the first baby boomer to apply for Social Security, the first of many. The Congressional Budget Office tells us that we will likely wind up spending about 10 percentage points of GDP more on Social Security and Medicare in 40 years than we do today. If nothing else changes, we would have to raise all federal taxes by more than 50% to pay the bill. But that can't happen, right? Well, Senator Hillary Clinton recently suggested that taxes will be the complete solution for Social Security. But her proposal to levy the Social Security tax for individuals making over $200,000, as opposed to the current cap of $97,500, would solve no more than 15% of Social Security's funding problem. And federal marginal tax rates on high earners would rise to 53%. Discouraging work, saving, and entrepreneurship. Of course, we could raise all taxes. Indeed, we'd have to. But there's a better way for economic growth and fairness. We could slow the rate of benefit growth for middle and upper income households while expanding saving incentives for all households to help prepare for retirement. After all, we should honor our Social Security promise to Ms. Casey Kirschling and preserve Social Security and a vibrant economy for our children.
Glenn Hubbard is the dean of the business school at Columbia University. He used to chair the Council of Economic Advisors under President Bush. Share your thoughts with us online. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on Contact. One of the godfathers of the video game industry launched a new game today, Richard Garriott's Tabula Rasa, the final episode in something called the Ultima series, is a far cry from the computer simulations he made before there was even a video game industry. And how things have changed. Last year, U.S. video game sales topped $7 billion, according to the Entertainment Software Association. From Austin, Texas, David Martin Davies reports on a new archive that's preserving the origins of the industry.
For hardcore gamers, Richard Garriott is something of a rock star. Standing in an Austin restaurant and arcade to launch Tabula Rasa, he's surrounded by adoring fans who want his autograph.
Thank you. When I was a teenager, I had some problems in my life, and some of your games really helped me out.
Oh, really? Fantastic. Oh, thank you so kindly. That's very nice of you to say that. Here's a poster for you, sir.
Garriott is a hero to his fans, but he describes himself as a nerd. While in high school in the early 1980s, Garriott started making computer games, selling them at the local computer store, then helped grow gaming into the juggernaut of an industry that it is today.
It's been interesting to watch how it's gone, how this industry has gone from being a computer nerd separatist activity to really being something that is now a very broadly accepted and adopted part of the universal culture of our planet.
Garriott and other pioneers are joining forces with the University of Texas to create a video game archive. Don Carlson is the director of the UT Center for American History, which will run the archive.
You know, one of the misunderstandings is that we're going to become some huge museum of video games. I mean, we will have examples of video games. But our interest is documenting how these video games were created.
When Carlson says documenting, he means paper, lots of it. The bulk of the archive will consist of original sketches and hand-drawn flowcharts of some of the first games. Some of these documents are scraps of graph paper with doodles of monsters in the corner. Brenda Gunn is in charge of the collection.
Well, I asked my husband, who is a big gamer, what he thought, and his reaction was, oh my goodness, you have the coolest job in the world.
But it's not all fun and games. Gunn has to organize all this paper, and she's a little overwhelmed. She's finding out that these game designers are pack rats.
They tell us that they've got their garages and their multiple storage units full of things.
After the material is cataloged, it'll be made available to researchers, and it'll lay the foundation for an eventual degree program, Video Game Studies. And your parents told you playing the Xbox was a waste of time. Little did they know.
Well, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, and it drives changes in computer technology, and whether you play games or not, you're buying a PC or a Macintosh in some form or another, and the developments for those computers have been driven by games.
As for video game god Garriott, he's gotten beyond the revenge of the nerds. He's a millionaire, and he's seen the industry he helped create get the respect it deserves.
You know, I go back to the earliest days where, you know, most businesses looked at it with scorn or at least ignored it, you know, out of insignificance.
No longer insignificant, video gaming is now American history. In Austin, I'm David Martin Davies for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, a three-year-old colt named Curlin won the Breeders' Cup last weekend. Earlier this year, he took third in the Kentucky Derby and second at Belmont. He's a $5 million horse. And as of today, he's got hundreds of new owners. It's all thanks to that big Fen-Phen diet drug lawsuit from several years ago. Two of the plaintiff's lawyers in that case are accused of bilking their clients out of a large portion of the class action settlement. The lawyers are part owners of Curlin. Today, a judge said the plaintiffs can claim that equine equity. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 27 points, 0.2%. The Nasdaq gained 15 points, 0.5%. The S&P traded flat. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Next time on the program, all that glitters is not gold. Sometimes it's diamonds.
What they are trying to do is to embellish the romantic concept of diamonds, which is fine. And they're selling a make-me-feel-good-today product.
I'm Tess Viglin. Don't forget to change your clocks. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.